You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
This podcast is being brought to you by our amazing sponsor, Voyage AC.
Hey, so I'm reading this from Harlow James.
Okay.
It says, Voyage AC Candles. This is a very well-known candle brand, but somewhat new to me. I had heard about their cult following for a while, so I decided it was time to finally test some out. The scents are incredible because they give off a lot without being too overpowering.
And that sounds like a rave review.
It is. And I think it's amazing that Voyage AC gets pressed like this, and yet this is no candle factory. Mm. Melanie Apple and her team hand pour every single candle. In fact, I spent a little time at their space not too long ago watching how the magic happens.
You did. I saw that video you posted on our Facebook group.
Yeah, it was an incredible day. And remember how good I smelled when I got home?
I do indeed.
Well, you'll want to check out all of Voyage AC's beautiful candles, phenomenal fragrances, and gorgeous face and body products. So, hun, how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now.
What?
Yep, that's 10% off everything you buy.
That's right. All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
Right? All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is the ultimate luxury blend of travel, design, and scents. Each original fragrance, every candle is handmade, 100% natural vegetable blend, and created by Melanie personally. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
Hi, my name is June Han, and I am the only U.S. citizen that has been deported and has come back to live in the United States. The one thing you got to remember is no matter what you do in America, they're always going to think of you as a yellow person. Like, no matter what you do, you're going to have to work twice as hard. You're going to have to, like, take insults without creating incidents. Mm-hmm. You're now living as a guest in these strangers' home. You're going to have to do things so much better than you did growing up. And they still might not call you American after all these years. So you're going to have to decide what that means for you.
What if two strange men arrived at your school with your mother and told you and your brother to get into a waiting car? Leading strategist, TEDx speaker, and mentor June Han was just a kid when immigration officers showed up and put his whole family on a plane back to the place where his parents were born, South Korea. But what would you do if, after being deported, your parents arranged for you and your brother to return to the United States and live with strangers, a white family, who had answered an ad in the local paper offering to take you in? Would you run away rather than be across the ocean from your mother and father? Or would you fly back to the States with your brother, ready to meet your new family? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they, too, had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. So, June Han, how are you?
I'm doing great. This is, all things considered, pandemic, usual, usual.
Yes, but we're coming out of it.
Absolutely. My last kid is getting vaccinated this weekend, so
nice.
I'm excited.
Yeah. Nice. So tell me, June, what would you rather do without for a year, AC and heat or your smartphone?
I would pay you to take my smartphone for a year.
You would?
Yeah. I mean, there are these like corporate retreats, and it's so funny the way they're designed. It's just like, we're going to take all your devices and we're going to take you to the woods for a weekend.
Yeah.
And people pay $6,000 for this kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? Just give me your phone right now. Like, pay me $6,000 a day. I'll just keep your phone from you.
Right.
Well, there is processing necessary when you take an adult's phone away. You have to process that. They need that counseling afterwards.
Yeah. Well, so the reason I was so quick on that one is that as soon as I learned that there is a phone detachment disorder, like it's an actual classified disorder now. And so that tells you like, whoa, that's not okay.
Right.
So as soon as I read that and looked at the research, I started to sleep with my phone in a different room because
like
what it's basically saying
went to another room.
Because what it is they're saying like if the average person, if the phone is more than 6 feet away from them, they start to palpably feel like stressed. Right. And what's even more stressful is if you don't know where your phone is.
Right. That is very stressful.
So I practice that all the time. I'll just leave it somewhere and go, you know what? Fuck that. Like today, if it's buzzing, I'll find it. But all my kids are home.
Right.
So what am I worried about? That's really the only time I'm really worried about my phone is if one of my kids is out, out about things like that. But like AC, I live in San Diego on purpose. Like we pay the sunshine tax and the great weather tax because we don't have
the
AC,
tax.
Yeah.
But the reality is like, I cannot handle heat. Like I cannot. And I lived in Korea. It's like, it's got humid summers and monsoons. And I was like, no one can live like that. It's horrible.
Right. So you want to keep your AC and you'll do without your phone. How many kids do you have, June?
I have three kids. I mean, the oldest one's like just graduated college.
Okay.
Yay, pandemic graduation. So it's hard to call her a kid, but obviously she'll always be a kid.
Right. Of course. Well, thank you so much for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I'm never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, hun. So today we're talking to June Han, who is such a great story. I can't wait to get to it.
Yeah, this is a great find, huh?
Yeah, but let me tell you just a little bit about him. This is what I have written down. Leading strategist June S. Han is the author and TEDx speaker of Get Ahead by Giving Back, and he gets to serve thousands of business leaders per year through keynotes, workshops, podcasts, and mentoring relationships, helping smart business owners grow from being busy to very effective. His passion is to help at least 10,000 entrepreneurs a year change the world for the better through their accelerated success. That's dope, right?
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
This is what we get. Instead of booking a session with you, we're going to record.
Yes. Record everything that you might give us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think maybe what we'll talk about will have something to do with what you do. But anyway, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But the first thing I want to ask you is, how do you identify now?
Well, I guess I always identify myself as a father, and there's a reason. I have two dads growing up, and I wasn't like thrilled of both of the ways that I was parented, but I always identify myself as a father. But, as far as like out in the public, I always say I'm Korean American.
Mm-hmm.
And among Korean people, Korean Americans, I guess, that were born here, I'm very much more Korean, which is odd. And then, but I'm very, very like white American as well. So it's kind of we'll get into that, but it's such a, it's weird to say, because when I was in college, I met a lot of Korean Americans, for the first time as like more of like, past my teenage years. And we were very different. Like I had more of a similar experience with like what they call like Korean adoptees, right? There was like a whole generation after the Korean War of Korean adoptees that grew up in all white context, you know, whether it be Canada or United States. And so I had a little bit in common with them, except they didn't have any kind of Korean identity. Whereas my Korean identity runs deep.
And
that's even like when I was a teenager, I have an older brother by exactly a year, and he was in all the same kind of childhood trauma as myself. But I realized the prevailing difference between he and I is that I always felt like Koreans were better than everyone else. You know, so I had like this deep seated, like, oh, Koreans, we do it right. You know, like my parents maybe didn't, but I remembered all that stuff growing up where my brother was always trying to fit in to like white majority culture.
Trying to assimilate.
Yeah. Right. And so we have very different, and still to this day, we react to the world very differently.
Interesting.
You know?
Well, and I also, I wanted to say before we get into the interview that you and I met at PodFest, which is hosted and put on by Chris Kremutzos, who I just adore and want to just thank and give a shout out to for connecting the two of us through that.
So, and I will tell you, these kind of connections, I mean, don't tell him, like, you know, we want him to get paid and stuff. But the connections like this is really, he loves stuff like this.
Yeah.
He loves, you know, so right now I know that, you know, when he hears this, he's going to
be smiling.
That was great.
Yeah.
Yes. He loves that, you know.
He does. And he just, you know, he speaks so highly of you. He was really excited when I told him we were going to have you on the show. I want to talk about, you were growing up in Southern California, right?
Yeah, mostly.
Mostly. We're going to go back to where, to the beginning where your family of origin, you're moving every 6 months to avoid ICE, but you didn't know this, right? You knew that you were moving, but you didn't know why you were moving.
Yeah, I think it wasn't until the actual day, maybe the day before we got deported that I realized, oh, now my childhood makes sense. Like, what, you know, when you're a kid, what's your baseline to compare it to, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just moved around all the time. Like, we moved around from ethnic enclave to, you know, mostly Korean-American, Korean neighborhoods, mostly throughout the LA kind of area. Mm-hmm. And then there was a period of time where I think my brother and I were living with my mom. And so we were moving different places. So we were like quite active. There was a period of maybe a couple of years where we were moving every 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
You know, back then it was called INS, right? Mm. Immigration and Naturalization Services. And, you know, it's crazy. It's like now as an adult, you look back and go, wait a minute, we were undocumented, but we owned houses. Like,
right.
Like my mom paid in cash and she bought a house. You know, and you pay taxes. And that's, you know, now when you talk to immigration attorneys, I realize, like, you know, you can apply for what they call a taxpayer ID, which is a 9-digit number. It's not a social security number, but it's a 9-digit number that allows you to pay taxes. Mm. And so when you get hauled in front of an immigration judge, that's the first thing they want to know is, like, have you been paying taxes for at least 5 years?
Right.
If you have, your case to stay in the United States is so much stronger because, like, the average American never wants to pay taxes.
Right.
Right. And so here's someone that's actually, you know, willingly paying taxes and is not the, you know, criminal element that gets sensationalized and, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. So that we moved around all the time. And it wasn't until I remember going into my fifth grade year, which is the year we got deported. I remember going into that school year going, wow, this is like the longest I've ever lived anywhere. And it was, you know, our third year living in a town called Cerritos, which is mm-hmm. right on the border of LA and Orange County.
Right.
And, you know, very much an ethnic enclave, very multi-ethnic, you know, when you look back at it. But yeah, moved around all the time.
So your mom, they pay for houses in cash. Your mom paid for houses in cash. What does she do for a living?
So I think like a lot of first generation immigrant stories, like my parents, between the two of them at any given time, probably had five to six jobs. You know, I remember, and again, these are all things now as you realize as an adult, like my dad worked in a building and then at night made extra money being the janitor in the same building.
Mm.
I can't imagine doing that, thinking that you're going to be seen by one of your coworkers or something,
right, you know, right, during the humility
you know, this is a college educated person. Things are not working out exactly like he had planned. And so he's, you know, pulling extra shifts. So my dad was, I mean, he was probably working 80, 90 hours a week. My mom, she did alterations, like she was a very good, you know, seamstress kind of
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
She also did something called Amway, which I didn't really know about until we got much older.
I know about Amway. Yeah.
So it's a network marketing kind of really for homemakers to mm-hmm. just make like a shit ton of money.
Right. Right.
You know, and my mom was very good at that. And so I know all of our expensive china, our goldware, all of that was through Amway. All our vacations were attached to Amway. So she was killing it. Like now as an entrepreneur, I realized like that stuff's hard. It's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And she was really good at it. She was in so many ways. I wish she was born today versus back when she was born. She had a petition to be one of the first women to go to her college in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was one of, I think, 7 inaugural women to go to her college and one of only 2 that graduated. You know, so I know if she stayed in Korea, she would have probably been like a government official because all her classmates were like pretty high ranking people, you know, in the Korean government and just like Korean, you know, the ecosystem there. Mm. So she did that. And so, you know, and she was just a saver. Like she would just hoard cash. And yeah, both of the houses that we ever owned were paid for in cash.
That's amazing.
It's crazy to me, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can say whatever you want about undocumented, and it's obviously a partisan kind of like whatever straw man kind of issue. But I mean, this is a woman that scrimped and saved and put down money.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. And that ethic, that work ethic that's tremendous. And the discipline that takes.
And I still remember those houses. Like our first one that we lived in, that was our house was in Canoga Park, you know? So I just recently, I think 3 months ago, I went to visit it and, you know, it's not the same house anymore, but it's still kind of the same layout. And it's right down the street from the elementary school that I remember that we would walk to.
Wow.
And then the last house that we owned was the house that we got caught in.
Right.
In Cerritos.
So, you know,
I remember that house greatly.
I was going to say, tell us about that. You were at school, right? When everything kind of went down?
Yeah, I remember this 100%. It was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And I only know that because, you know, Thanksgiving at Thursday and Friday off. So this is like a mega weekend.
Right.
You know, but specifically like my friends, I had play dates with a couple of my friends that live close by, but there was always like two or three friends we can never get together all at once. And this was like, we were finally all going to be at my house this afternoon and we're going to have a slumber party. It was like the best day.
Yeah.
Right. The school day kind of drags because you're just waiting for it to end because it's, you know, going to the weekend. But over the intercom, you know, like, would June and Young Han, please, my brother Young, would you please come to the office? And, you know, my kids go to a different school now, but like back in the schools I went to, like principal office was not like because you were a good kid.
Right. Right.
You know, so we get out in the hallway and I run into my brother and he's like, dude, what'd you do? I'm like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? What did I do? What did you do?
Mm.
You know, because we have never been called to the principal's office. I'm like, my brother and I were horrible kids at home.
Right.
But not at school. We were like very much what you consider like the model minority or whatever you want to call it. Right.
Yeah.
Great, great students. So we show up into the principal's office and there's my mom. And she's like, hey, go back and get your stuff. We're going to go visit your dad. These are two friends of your dad. So we're going to go visit him in his office. You know, so we're in Cerritos and he's up on Olympic Boulevard up in, you know, downtown L.A.
What did two friends of your dad, I'm putting that in quotes, look like?
So as soon as we got out of the principal's office, my brother shocked me. He's like, hey, who can you stay with? Like, we need to leave school right now. We can't go. We need to, like, go stay with one of your friends and I'll stay with one of my friends.
Oh.
I was like, what are you talking about, dude? He's like, dude, look at those two guys. They were dressed in matching like blue metallic-y kind of shiny suits, matching suits. And one was white and one was black. And my brother said, those are not friends of our dad.
Yeah.
Our dad doesn't have a single non-Korean friend.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And all the friends we know of are either business or from church or whatever. And so he's like, dude, that's not, whatever's happening there is not good.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to like bail. And I remember thinking like, dude, I'm like 10 years old. What are you talking about?
Right, right.
And I think it surprised me because my brother's like, you know, he's only 11 at that point.
He was up on it though.
Right. He's a sixth grader and he's just like, dude, we got to split. And I was like, well, I don't think that's the plan. So we ended up not doing that. In hindsight, like that might have been an interesting adventure. Right.
Right.
It's just like somehow split and been on the land for the last like 20 years. But so we went back and, you know, the whole time I told my friends like, hey, you know, I remember telling my teacher, like, oh, can I just talk to my friends real quick before I go? And she's like, okay. And I'm telling them, like, hey, don't forget, like, 4 o'clock, my house, you know, like, super excited. And then we get in the car and then we drive over to our house. And that's when we realized, like, so as soon as we left the school grounds and we got in the car, they put handcuffs on my mom.
Mm.
And we're oh, yeah. So this is not, this is clearly not like, it's exactly what my brother was thinking. I was like, we should have made a run for it or whatever, you know, but as a 10-year-old, who thinks of that kind of stuff, right? Like, let's make a run for it or whatever.
Yeah.
So then we go to the house and I remember they let my mom go in with one of the agents. That's what I'll call them. Cause I think that's what they are. They're officers or they're agents, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't know what the technical term is, but they go in and the other guy, so the black gentleman goes in with my mom and they're just like, you know, letting her pack, which is great, right? We got like three dogs, so I don't know what's happening with them, you know, a lot of the time.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you got a lot of stuff. So like, you know, how are you going to pack a grand piano?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like my clarinet or my brother's saxophone or whatever, right? You know, the other gentleman is sitting in the car and I just remember what he asked us. He's like, hey, so do you guys play any sports? And we're like, well, my brother and I are both kind of heavy set. So like, I wasn't very athletic. My brother was like, he carried his weight definitely a lot better than I did. And we're like, oh, no, we don't really play sports, but, you know, but we do martial arts. And he's like, oh, yeah, what's that? I'm like, well, we do taekwondo, and we've been doing it for, like, 3 years. And then I remember he wrote it down in his notebook, and then he turned around and never talked to us again.
Weird.
Like, that whole time, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, what? You know, and again, like, I don't know what the point of that was, but as a 10-year-old, you're just like, just what's going on? Like, you know, and so mom comes back. I think she has two suitcases. And she gets in the car, and then we go to my dad's office. And, you know, this place is a travel agency on Olympic Boulevard. You know, it specializes in, obviously, like, Korean clients and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. so this office usually has, like, 40 people in there. It's bustling. It's always busy. But we show up, and there's the owner, who we know, because, you know, friends of my dad. And then there's my dad. And there's, like, an admin assistant. And there's only three people in this whole office.
Mm. They cleared out,
like,
huh?
Yeah, we're like, what is... And again, like, in hindsight, you're like... yeah,
mm-hmm, right.
You know, they let everyone know what's going on.
Yeah,
and got out of there because I think my mom was allowed to talk to my dad. You know, and it's really interesting that point that I think now as an adult, like, did my dad think of leaving? You know, right. Like what was he thinking of? And you know, knowing who my dad is, I realize he probably wouldn't have entertained that. But I just think like, well, those are the decisions you make as an adult, right? So
well, in that fight or flight, right?
Yeah, just like, wow, this is it. Like,
yeah.
We've been running, and we thought we were clear. You know, it's been 3 years, and look at this. And so, you know, they pick up my dad, and then we start driving. I don't know how long. As, you know, as a kid, it's hard to know. But I remember thinking, like, I had never seen a line this long in my life. And it was all, you know, Latinx faces, like Hispanic-looking people. I only had a couple, you know, a couple Mexican friends growing up. And so... looking around, like, oh, they kind of look like my friend Gilbert's family. But dude, there's a lot. I mean, this line had to be like a quarter mile long.
Wow.
Like we saw the line. The line was lined up well before we even saw the building that we were supposed to head to. And it was like a fence, and all these people just lined up on this fence in differing states. You know, some people looked really nice, like really dressed up. And some people look like maybe, you know, they're wearing like fourth or fifth hand-me-downs or kind of stuff. But I just remember being taken aback at how long the line was. And because I think also like made the car slow down a little bit, like in a movie, you know, slow down. And so we just were, it took our sweet time to get to this building. And finally, when you turn this corner, you could see the building and we get in there. And then all I remember from that time is like, you know, we're in the cell. And I remember one of the agents said, hey, we were able to get your whole family your own cell. Right. And I remember thinking like, well, is that like cool? You know, but, and, you know, when you think about it, it's like, that's humanity to that, right? That we had our own cell. The only things I remember about that were like, we were super hungry. And the only thing we could eat were vending machine sandwiches from across the hall.
Yeah.
And I had never had really a sandwich ever in my life up to that point. You know, I'm 10 years old, ethnic food at home, and brought that food for lunch and all that kind of stuff. And so still to this day, like I've grown to appreciate a very well-made sandwich, you know, but that's not my default for like,
but that's, you know, not your like, comfort food.
Yeah. That's not my comfort food, you know, and that's like the worst way to get introduced to sandwiches, right? It's
right.
Like a vending machine
yes.
and an INS detention facility. But
I can taste them. Like
yeah,
that stale
yeah,
white
good.
Bread and then the slice of ham and cheese.
It's not good.
Yeah.
And then the thing that I still remember, I mean, the thing that I'll never forget is like, you know, like there was a bathroom, like there was a toilet, but it wasn't like a stall.
Right.
There's just like a toilet in the middle of this room.
Yeah.
And, you know, most people, they kind of freeze up, you know, so like, I think for my brother and I, like, it took us a long time to be able to go to the bathroom. And I remember my mom saying like, oh, well, do you want me to like block the view and stuff like that? And you're like, that's even more awkward. There's like a mom standing right next to me, you know, I'm trying to take care of business. And it's because we had our cell had like one-way glass. Like you could see through the windows when they opened the door and the light bounced out. But like we could tell there was a huge office on the other side of, you know, everyone could look in. So we knew we were being like observed like in the zoo kind of dynamic. So we were there for just under 2 days. And then the way it's explained to me now is I got more questions answered when I was at college. Like, what was that whole process? They're like, well, they said you can either wait for a judge because your two sons are American citizens. They're, you know, they were born here. They have rights, you know. But the judge is on Thanksgiving holiday, and so you'd have to stay in the cell for basically 3 weeks before your hearing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like constitutional right to a, you know, speedy trial, that kind of stuff. But the thing is, he's gone on vacation for 10 days, and then there's a backlog. I mean, we saw the line.
Yeah.
You know,
right,
people coming in.
Yeah.
And it's not like we're like wealthy, right? So there's no like prioritization. We don't have a lawyer coming to bail us out and all this kind of stuff. So the calculus was like, you could stay here for 3 weeks and I think my dad was explaining, he's like, they had basically intimated to him, like, you don't have a great case. You know, like, it's not guaranteed that in the hearing is going to go your way.
Right.
So just to factor that in so that, you know, by our third day there, we were on a flight to Korea. You know, then all these questions like, oh, wait a minute. We have never been to Korea.
Right.
For a family that is so proud of being Korean. And then so then you start asking questions like, oh, is this why we've never been? You know, and also like, you know, my mom, like we only had like one relative ever come to visit us. And now it's all making sense, right? It's like in those movies when you at the end there's like a twist,
yeah,
right? And then you go back, they flash all the scenes from the
right. Everything makes
like,
sense.
Oh,
yeah.
Like mm-hmm. you know Kaiser Soze or whatever, right. You know, like kind of stuff. And so yeah. that was that moment for me, like on the plane ride over, because you know it's 17 hours, you got a lot of time
yeah.
to think. You know, we're going to meet all these people that we've heard stories of. We've even talked to them on the phone, but you know we've never met them. It's yeah. not like they had Zoom or you know Facebook sure. chat back then. So there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of like, well, that's cool, like to go to Korea, right? But then it's like, oh, but like we're not like. First of all, I miss my like sleepover,
yeah,
awesome party thing.
You yeah. know, happening.
That's long gone. But you know, is this like a temporary thing? And they're like, mm-hmm. well. And so I remember the agents that picked us up in Cerritos were still with us the whole time. So they went
on the plane with you.
Yeah, so they actually escorted us onto the plane, right? Which wow. I feel like is like, hey, that's like white glove service. That's pretty cool, you know?
Right.
Like,
right.
Kind of stuff. I would love to find those guys some way, somehow. Like, were they tracking us all these years? I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But it's unusual that they would walk you, like they're the ones that walked us onto the plane, like physically onto the plane.
Mm.
And I remember overhearing the conversation they had with my parents. It's like, listen, in 10 years, the records that we keep on the U.S. side are going to be erased.
Yeah.
But it's the job of every other country to keep track of people that have broken like visa kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know when you'll be able to come back. Your sons can come back tomorrow if
right.
they wanted to.
Right.
But from your guys' point of view, the U.S. will keep no records of you past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it's up to the Korean government on whether or not they're going to extend a visa to you to come or all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Wait, I want to ask you, do you speak Korean?
You know, if my life depended on it, I could do it.
Did you then when you were 10?
Oh, no. So it's like, it's even worse when you think about like, so when you go to Korean church, they actually like 2 hours before church, you go to Korean school. And pretty much, I think most like ethnic, like, you know, immigrant cultures have a version of this. Like,
right.
You know, for Chinese schools usually on Saturday. I think Vietnamese school does the same thing.
There's and Greek school too.
Yeah, Greek school. Yeah. So there's mm-hmm. all these versions of that. So
yeah.
we had Korean school 2 hours before church, which is always a drag because we'd have to be there early anyways because my parents were like part of the leadership or whatever. So we'd always have to be super early and it sucked. And then what made it even worse was that in Korean school, like every year, kids like get promoted to different grades, right? Because
yeah.
we're good at Korean. Well, my brother and I were in a special group of kids that never promoted. So we were like, if you think about this, this is probably the worst thing to do. They put us all in the same classroom together. We're all mixed ages, So like my brother and I, you know, we're like 9 and 10 or eight and, you know, seven, mm-hmm. whatever, when we're starting out, we're in a class with like high school kids.
Right.
High school kids that are obviously not very good role models because they're not advancing in Korean school either. And so this class, I mean, it was so much fun.
Yeah.
That's where I learned to break dance. That's where I learned to, like, there was a liquor store down the street from our church and we could buy, you know, soda pop and candy there and ice cream. There's an arcade, you know, like we learned all these non-Korean related things
in Korean school. Because you guys weren't learning Korean.
Right. But then where it catches up to you is you're on this plane going to Korea.
Right.
And you're like, oh, man. So it's interesting in that, like, I think my Korean is okay. You can definitely tell I have an accent.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was traveling back and forth, so I haven't been in probably about maybe 8 years, last time I've been there. But when I would travel back and forth, you know, this was in high school and in college, my tongue would actually physically change a little bit. It's so interesting. And I think that's only because I lived in Korea for like 2 years. It was immersed and was clearly like a native speaker by the time I left. And so when you're on the airplane, it starts to change because now everyone's speaking to you in Korean, right? The flight staff and everything. And then it got to the point where when I came back to the States with our white family, I would beg them, don't make me be in front of anyone I know for the 2 days.
Because in those two days,
I would have an accent when I spoke English.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you could hear the words coming out of your mouth going, what the hell is that coming out of my mouth? But it's because your tongue is physically doing different things. There are sounds in Korean that don't exist, and there's sounds in English that don't exist in Korean, right?
So there's like a metamorphosis.
So I remember the first, it was so embarrassing. The very first time we came back, like I had school the very next day, and I could hear myself talking, going, what is going on? And I just would. And so then after like the second time of that happening, I was like, listen, this has to be the deal. I can't be in front of my friends. Yeah. I can't be in front of anyone that I know for 2 days, you know.
So tell me, you guys land in Korea. And I know that you don't stay in Seoul. You're in a farming community. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. Today, it is one of the most modern cities in the world. And that's Incheon. That's where the international airport is built now. But when I lived there, Incheon was famous for being the place where there's like a MacArthur statue, General MacArthur, that commemorated his there, you know, to help fight back the communists and whatnot. It's a seaside village, but it, you know, it smelled like manure almost the whole time throughout the year because it was a farming village. And so I think there's a part of me that really appreciates the fact that we lived in the country because we got to experience parts of Korea that almost don't exist anymore. Definitely not in that city. Like a lot of my friends have told me, if I go back to my hometown in Incheon, I won't recognize it and it'll, you know, drive me to tears or whatever, because it's so modern. Like they were on a campaign to become the world's most high-tech city, you know, and that's why they built the airport there. But if we lived in Seoul, if we had stayed there, Seoul even back then was a little more westernized. Like, so the biggest example is like in Seoul, they didn't beat you in school.
Right.
They just didn't because it was that Western.
Yes.
There were a lot more teachers that spoke English. Like everyone in Korea, like, you know, public education, I don't know if it's like this now, but back then it was only funded until elementary school. So if you're going on a junior high and high school, it means you were either wealthy or a good student. Like you were getting scholarships and grants.
Oh.
And this is pretty much the world over. I think everyone starting in junior high, like in Korea, you learn Mandarin and you learn English, you know, so everyone kind of knows a little bit of English, but, you know, not really fluent. So like in our school, there was only like maybe four teachers that were really conversational in English.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher was because he had served in the military alongside of a lot of American troops. And so
in your school in Incheon.
Yeah, in our school in Incheon, they beat us. And my brother and I, because we sucked at Korean, we got beat quite often.
You were telling me about some test that had like 100 answers and you got hit.
This is actually the like flashpoint, if you will, of why my brother and I came back. So basically what happened when my brother and I started school in Korea, we would do a normal school day and then we would stay afterwards for 2 hours. And then our teacher would help us catch up in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it was very clear to me about 6 months in that my brother's teacher was teaching him very differently than my teacher was. You know, she was using him more as like an English conversation partner, which wasn't really helping his Korean.
Mm.
And also my brother's not as verbal. So like, that's not the best way to teach him anyway. And so by the time I finished fifth grade, I was up to a fifth grade reading level. So I was only one grade behind going into sixth grade. My brother, on the other hand, going into seventh grade, he was still like at a third or fourth grade reading level going into middle school. So that was not going to bode well for him. And, you know, our family had money. So, he was able to go to middle school. Mm-hmm. In middle school, again, they start teaching you Mandarin and English. So my brother's just kicking ass in English class, obviously, just like, right. You know, the star pupil and, you know, having all these conversations with the teacher and the teacher's loving it. But then he's got to take Mandarin, and Mandarin is a difficult, difficult language, mm-hmm. to the point to which, you know, it's one of these symbol based languages. So there's not phonetic. There's no letter structure. You know, Korea advanced as a society when one of our kings, our best king, King Sejong, they actually call him Sejong Daewang, it's like the grand king. He basically liberated Koreans by coming up with Korean. Like, he invented it, because he said Mandarin, you can only learn if you're well off. Like, because you have to sit down, and there's the way you teach you, there's a story. There's like a book that's a story, and it has characters that doesn't repeat. Mm. And you learn from like that word means sky. This word means grass. This mm-hmm. word means river. And so you, as a noble person, you would just sit there and you would learn this story, and then you match it up with the Chinese characters. And that's how you learn Mandarin.
So
in the old days,
he created a language.
He basically went blind.
Wow.
It was like the last thing he wanted to do. He's like, we will never be a great people if we have to learn Mandarin, because it's not democratic. Mm. Right? It takes so long to learn. You have to be a noble person to do that. We can't do that. We need to be literate. So he created Korean. It's like one of the last great things he did for our country. He went basically literally blind creating it. Mm-hmm. Now, and he had to do it in secret. Because if they knew he was doing that, he would have been executed by the Chinese different emperors and whatnot.
Wow.
In the day. And so it's like this great, phenomenal. And so it's interesting. You look at the history of Korean today. There are some countries that don't have a written language. Like, they're mostly like a spoken language. Mm-hmm. And they have adopted Korean as a written language because it's so easy to learn.
Oh, wow.
Like, the phonetic structure of it, right?
Right,
so
right.
It's crazy to think about it. Like, no one ever do that in English, because English is like a mutt language. There's too many exceptions, and it's hard.
Yes.
You know, the O-U-G-H sound.
Oh, my goodness.
It's like eight different sounds.
Yes,
you know?
Cough through thought.
So, you know, my brother comes home. He has a Mandarin exam, and there's 100 questions. Mm. And he missed 99 out of 100. And so, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, my gosh. I'm like, dude, he got one right? That's pretty good. That's, like, phenomenal, I think, for my brother. But he comes home and his left hand is starting to swell up. Like, it was swollen like a tennis ball size, maybe racquetball size, mm. when he got home. But by the time he got to dinner, it was like the size of a softball. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't bend his fingers. And basically what it is like, if you grew up in Incheon back in the day and you were raised in that school system, you basically learned how to get hit. Because the teachers are not trying to, they're not trying to hurt you. You know, they're not trying to create like physical harm, because a lot of these kids are farmers' kids, so they need to be able to work.
Well, they don't
and stuff
want to
like
injure
that.
You.
Yeah, they're not
right.
trying to injure you.
Yeah.
They're going to hurt
yeah.
you, but not injure
yeah.
you, right? Yeah, you're right. But my brother, not knowing that, like, he would flinch a little bit after and he's getting hit 99 times, by the way, you know, for every question he missed. Cause that's basically how it worked. Like, for every question we missed on homework, we get hit. For every question we missed on a test. And so think about that. That makes you like a really good student really quick.
Yes. Yes.
Or it makes you really strong and mm-hmm. calloused, and you just say whatever.
Right.
You know, so my knucklehead friends in elementary school, they were the kind that they just took the beatings, which is like the worst friend to have, because we would get in trouble all the time. And most of my beatings are not academic related at all. They're all like behavior stuff. Because my friends in the back, we were all in the back row because I was one of the tallest kids. Because mm-hmm. like, you know, American nutrition and stuff back in the day. But he came home and he got hit. And every time he got hit, he moved his hand a little bit. So the teacher was trying to hit a certain spot of his hand. But because he was flinching a little bit, it was hitting like the knuckle part, which is not what they're trying to do.
That's
they're
the
trying
worst.
To hit like the meaty. They're trying to hit like the meaty part of the hand, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing to injure there permanently. And so my mom, you know, I already told you, my mom's like a pioneering personality. You know, she rushed dinner together. Just, you know, here's the food. I'll be back. She goes into the principal's office. And mm-hmm. in Korean schools, like, all the teachers are in the office, like, together. It's like a office building. They don't sit in their classrooms. They do all their work at these desks next to each other. And it's like built like just any kind of normal office. And she runs in there, grabs the principal by the necktie, and is like screaming bloody murder. So they had to get other teachers to pull her off of the guy. Because
she went
was
mama
like,
bear.
She went mama bear.
Yeah.
And she came home that night. And I remember her, you know, hearing her and my dad argue. We couldn't hear the full conversation, but basically that's the night they decided like, we need to come back to the United States, because mm-hmm. school was only going to get harder.
Yeah.
You know, Korea has like their version of the SAT is not ours. It's like it's ours on steroids. It's only offered once. And that test determines almost your whole fate in life, which is a weird thing if you think about the way like Japan and Korea and some of the education system runs. So you take this one test. If you get an A, you get to go to the A colleges. And you would not ever go to a B or C college mm-hmm. because you got the A. So the A college is doctors, engineers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The B college is like corporate CEOs, whatever.
Yeah.
C college is so social workers and artists, you know, kind of stuff. And then if you got a D, that means you're going to be blue collar for the rest of your adult life.
Wow.
It's like fated. It's
that's
fated,
amazing.
Basically. Right? I always joke with my kids because I'm like, listen, if you guys were in Korea, you'd be going to school on Saturdays, just like I did. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd go and do these tutoring centers for 3 hours after school. But then, you know, as my kids got older, they go like, because we saw some plays about what it's like, the pressure of that in Korea. And like, yeah. Korea has one of the, is I think the world's leader, unfortunately, in youth suicide.
Mm.
And it's all because of that one damn test.
Wow.
You know, people yeah. commit suicide before, and I think even more committed after.
Afterwards, sure.
Right?
So I want to move us ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I was like,
no,
hey,
no,
man,
it's okay. It's okay.
So now
I'm
only 12 years old at this point.
Right. So you're 12 years old. Your parents, they've decided to send you back, which I know must have been heartbreaking for them. I'm assuming that they decided to send you to families that they knew first.
But
you,
right.
Right. So they were looking for a place for you guys to go. And you said that you guys had a reputation, you and your brother.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. So like I said, like we were great students at school.
Mm-hmm.
But at home, especially when we had babysitters, like we never had a repeat babysitter. No one ever. And this is like, you know, we're talking like probably 20 different Korean communities.
Yeah.
Because my parents moved around so much, right?
Right,
like,
right.
We just had this notorious reputation of like, no, both of you are like a handful, which tells you a lot about my poor mom. I remember like when we were little, uh-huh. like we would hide in the mall, right? Like in the clothing racks. And so I remember my mom was over the intercom in this mall. She's speaking to us in Korean because she knows that people can't understand it. She's like, Young and June, please come meet me in front of this thing. I'm going to kill you
right.
when we get home. Because this is so embarrassing. If you can hear my voice,
right.
you have 5 seconds to find your way to this place. We were just horrible kids. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the other thing I think of like when they made a decision to send us back, as a parent now, I think I didn't understand it until I became a parent that like they basically, if something went wrong when they sent us back, they couldn't physically come and do anything. They were physically
right.
blocked. They couldn't come.
Yeah.
Right? They have to rely on the kindness of some family friends to intervene on our behalf. But
yeah,
that's crazy if you think about it.
Well, it's really, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of faith. And the fear of having you stay there must have outweighed that for them to think.
Yeah, just really the prospects. And it really right. was, you know, in the time sensitive part was my brother, right? Because he's only getting older.
Sure.
School's
sure.
not going well.
Yeah.
And for many years, I think my brother carried that guilt. But I was like, dude, it's not your fault that our parents got deported. Like, you know,
right.
like, it's
yeah.
like, it's like, it's their fault. They were adults. They did something. We got deported. Like, it's not your fault.
Right.
But,
he shouldn't but
he
carry
carried,
that.
He carried that for so long.
Oh.
But it was interesting. So we, you know, we could hear my mom and dad working the phones and whatnot. And basically what they're doing is because they're always like in church leadership. They're just contacting all these pastors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, you know, who do you think would do this? And basically all these pastors are calling them back and saying, listen, there's, you know, such and such family will take your oldest son. And then such and such family be glad to take your younger son.
Mm.
But there wasn't one single family that would take both of us, right?
Wow.
So then you think about it from my mom's perspective, like, my sons are already being separated from us.
Yeah, no.
We got to have them together because at least they can watch each other's back, right?
Yeah,
or have some semblance of family. That went on for months. And then all of a sudden in the mail, we started getting all these letters from white families.
Mm.
Like, and again, we don't know any white people.
Right.
Right? You
right.
know, like, I think even all of our landlords, like we grew up in an ethnic enclave, so even our landlords are not white people, you
yeah.
know, necessarily. We're getting letters from just these like white families with pictures of them and like stuff about like, oh, we'd love to have your boys live with us. And we're like, what is going on? And so basically what ends up happening is one of the pastors just realizes like, listen, this is sad. Now, there's not a single family in our congregation
mm-hmm.
of like 300 families that will help this other family out, even though we've known them for years and, you know, all this stuff. So in the Orange County Register, I think still to this day, they run like this troubleshooter like column.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it is every single day, there's two different needs that are written about. And then they never repeat the story again. It's just two different needs. So this pastor's like, listen, I don't know what to do. Maybe we'll just send in the story to this thing. So he said, here, there's these two boys that are American citizens. Their family's been deported. They'd like to come back to finish their education. Can anyone help?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he wrote.
That's where all the letters were coming from. People were answering that.
Right.
Yeah.
I've actually seen the column. You know, it was basically the first need was like this convalescent home was looking for a donation for like a van with a wheelchair lift
mm-hmm.
or something like that, right? Because it was
right.
expensive, right?
Yeah. So
and then the second, and then the second one was like us, these
yeah.
two boys, you know. And so that's where it's coming from, right? And it's all these families from Orange County and LA.
Yeah.
And my parents are like, what are we supposed to do with this, right? So I thought at that point, like that's it. We're just going to live in Korea and. You know, my brother and I will not go to college. We'll just
mm-hmm.
figure something out. You know, well, you know, you could still kind of find your way as an entrepreneur, maybe, you know.
Right.
My parents are still pursuing it. And, you know, it's crazy if you think about it. So what basically convinced them was there's this family. They were divorced. They're both divorcees. It's their second marriage.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any kids from the second marriage because they're quite a bit older. They felt like you know, God was telling them that these two kids were like the right age as if they got married and had kids. Yeah. They would be their kids. And, you know, they had like a glowing letter of recommendation from a pastor, which, you know, nowadays you can just buy on the internet.
Right.
So, but, you know,
but back then it was legit.
But back then it was probably legit. Letterhead from the church, whatever. You know, they were both entrepreneurs, very successful, lived in a really nice city called San Clemente, California. It's like, you know, it's a lap of luxury kind of place.
Yeah.
And I think they had two phone calls with them and then we were off.
Wow. So tell me about, because you turned 12 when you landed, is that right?
I turned 12 the day after I landed.
Yeah, so tell me about that.
So first of all, you know, the ride to the airport, I remember my mom got with my brother, because, you know, we had big suitcases, so we took two different cabs. And it's about like a two-hour ride. And so my dad sits with me, and he's driving, and he's trying to, like, I don't know, what do you do? It's the last time you're going to talk to your son in person for a while. I've since, you know, decoded kind of what my mom talked to my brother about and what he remembers from that. But for me, what I remember is my dad saying, like, this is how you use cutlery. Like, you use the utensils on the outside coming in. You know, it's like bread, food, water is going to be the order if you're sitting at a fine dining establishment. You know, like, and the thing that I'll never forget, which is very much my dad's worldview. He's like, you know, June, the one thing you got to remember is no matter what you do in America, they're always going to think of you as a yellow person. Like, no matter what you do, you're going to have to work twice as hard. You're going to have to, like, take insults without creating incidents. You're now living as a guest in these strangers' home. You're going to have to do things so much better than you did growing up. And they still might not call you American after all these years. So you're going to have to decide what that means for you, right?
Wow.
And so, again, you're like I'm a 12-year-old kid. Like, what does that mean, right?
Yeah.
So it's only in hindsight I've unpacked what that saying means, but that statement. But we get on the airplane, and the whole time the coach was like, call them like sir and ma'am, right? Proper manners and all stuff. And the first thing is, you know, like, oh, yes, sir. And they're like, whoa. No. My name's John and my name's Donna. You can call us by our names. And that's a very white person thing, by the way.
Yeah.
Like no one in Korea will ever let you call them by their first, like, like, there are some kids until they're like 8 years old. They don't really know their parents' names.
right.
Like, you know, cause they just know it's Aman Appa or Amani Abaji. And you don't ever call anyone by their name. Like, it's
disrespectful, right?
That's super, it's like beyond disrespectful.
Right.
You know, but like, you know, we realized like right away, like white parents want to be everyone's friend, you know? So they're like, hey, call me Jack. Or you're like, no, man, I'm going to call you sir or Mr. So-and-so, you know, but they don't like that. Cause like, they don't want to feel old.
Right.
And
right.
Whatever. But so right away we're like culture shock of like, oh
yeah.
Okay. So no ma'am and sir. Or whatever. And then they had thought it was a great way, like the very next day. So first day, you're kind of jet lagged, whatever. The second day, because it was actually my 12th birthday, they invited all these people over to meet us, right? But it's all adults, dude. It's all adults,
oh,
right?
No.
I mean, because we don't have any friends, right?
Right.
So
it's
all adults. And they're all saying, oh, call me Sherry. And, you know, call me. You're like, dude. This is not like
it's you guys
not,
are like standing like with your arms folded, looking around like, what is this?
It is not. That was really uncomfortable. And then I started school. I started school that Monday. You know, we flew in like a 4 o'clock on a Friday. There was the big party Saturday night. You know, Sunday went to white people church with my family and met the pastor that was on the name of the letter. And it ends up being one of the best human beings I've ever met in my life. And then, Monday in school. And I'll tell you, this is when you grow up in an ethnic enclave, there's not a lot of, like, even when you're teenager stuff, there's not a lot of sexuality kind of stuff. But my school now I'm going to in San Clemente, it's like, I was like, I want to say 70% white, right? And the other percent is like Mexican.
Right.
And so that San Clemente is kind of still divided along those lines. So like during class time, I was with all the white kids. And during recess, I was with all the Mexican kids. Really interesting. When I started getting into like advanced placement classes in middle school and starting middle school and then all through high school, I never saw my elementary school playground friends ever again. You know, two of them I didn't see until the day I graduated high school in the graduation line.
Wow.
You know, it's crazy. Right?
Yeah,
it tells you a little bit of kind of how, you know,
the divide. You know,
there's things that they're trying to fight against that now as far as like, you know, gate or tracking and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I remember it was so traumatic on the bus ride home, all these kids talking about like who's making out with who. And I just remember thinking like, what is going on? Right. And it was like, it just felt so like liberal and like adultish.
Yes.
The very next day I walked out of our house towards the bus stop and my brother and I had two different buses because he was going straight to middle school, which I cannot even imagine going straight into middle school. Right.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, kind of like a fobby, fresh off the boat, kind of like whatever.
Right.
Like, we didn't have time to get new clothes yet. Right.
Oh,
so I just can't imagine what that was like for him. But so I go and I walk towards the bus stop and then I circle back and I just hide in our, I hide in our backyard.
Oh,
I didn't go to school because it was so traumatic.
Mm.
And then I got routed out by our little terrier dog. came out because my mom worked mostly from home. You know, she was a PhD in clinical psychology, so she ran a counseling center. But you know, she do a lot of the admin stuff at home.
Mm-hmm.
So she lets Bonnie out for like to go use the yard, and Bonnie's like yapping at me. And I was like, Bonnie, but Bonnie and I only know each other for like 2 days, right? So it's not going well. And then, you know, I remember my mom coming out and be like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, she was like, obviously very concerned.
Yes.
Because I was just like sitting there, and I was going to wait out the whole damn day, Laura. I was going to wait out the whole damn day.
In the yard.
And then just act like, you know, yeah, school time, come back.
Yep.
And act like I had a great day at school. And
blend
so,
in.
Yeah. So she asked me kind of what it was about. And the next day I was on the bus again at school.
Wow. June, I mean, it's such an incredible story. And, you know, the part two, which we won't have time to tell, but maybe when you talk to Scott after our interview, you'll be able to tell him a little bit about it. But the part two would be what your life was like once you came back. And like I just heard you say very glibly, my mom, when you were talking about the family that adopted you.
I just call it like my white mom.
Yeah.
And then my Korean mom.
Yeah. Your white mom, Korean mom. But just a couple of questions before we close. Because it's so fascinating. Tell me what you learned from your white family that you might not have learned from your Korean parents if you had stayed in Korea.
Yeah, I'll say it's an interesting case study if you want to look at it just clinically, right? Because both sets of my families were very entrepreneurial.
Right.
My white family, the dad was a Scottish immigrant, thick Scottish accent. When he got mad, couldn't understand a word he was saying.
Really?
Right? Which made him more mad because we're just laughing.
Right.
Like, we have no idea what you're talking about. He's getting even more mad. And then my mom, my white mom, she's like, you know, third generation Italian American. So basically white. She grew up in the desert out of Nevada, mm-hmm. riding dirt bikes. And, you know, she only later in life started to like try to claw back and find her Italian kind of roots, you mm-hmm. know, but, you know, mostly from the Midwest. And then they ended up being Nevada and all that kind of stuff. So very, very like typical white family, but entrepreneurs nonetheless. Right.
Yeah.
So here's my Korean parents working five jobs between two of them, scrimping enough money to like buy a house in cash twice.
Right.
But none of those jobs would have like helped them be set up to retire,
mm-hmm.
right? Those are the jobs that like help us succeed so the kids can be successful. You know, because I always wanted to be a doctor since I was 10 years old and all this kind of stuff. But my white parents, what they understood about business is fundamentally different. And I think this is the crazy thing about America, that I use the word hidden curriculum a lot. And so sociologists will say hidden curriculum are things that are never taught in schools, but are taught around dinner tables,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is how wealthy people teach their kids about how endowments work and stock portfolios and stuff at like age five. Right. And how property taxes work and shelters and like we're not going to pay an inheritance tax. And it's all this kind of stuff. Right. It's like I recently had for the pandemic, I made my kids rewatch all my favorite movies, you know, and we have those old VHS machines. So I made them watch A Few Good Men.
Mm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because in there is a prime example. The Code Red is the example of hidden curriculum. It's not anywhere in the manual. Right. And the court case turns with Tom Cruise approaches a young Noah Wiley and says like, hey, I looked at this whole manual. Where's the mess hall? It doesn't say anywhere in here where the mess hall is. And he's like, well, everyone knows. It's like, blah, 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 you know?
Right.
And that's what convinced the jury of like, oh,
right.
There are these things that are codified that are not written down or taught, but are very strong. And so that's the hidden curriculum, right? The code red and all that stuff. And so what my white parents taught me is a different way to look at America. So like, I think if you are not afraid of being caught by INS, your posture towards debt looks differently,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you can grow your business very fast and strong if you're comfortable with debt. Debt that will be subsidized by the U.S. government will be backed by bankruptcy laws if it need be, right? But mm-hmm. think about our bankruptcy laws. Even if you fuck it all up, like 10 years later, you get to try again.
Right, right.
right? Yeah. If you have a good corporate attorney, you could do it like, you know, former president. You could mm-hmm. you could bankrupt certain companies every year if you wanted to. And there's actually a tax strategy behind that if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
So like what I learned from my white parents was like how the establishment works.
Mm-hmm.
And college wasn't just about getting a good job. College is about networking. College is about the soft skill development, which is not what any immigrant tells their kids when they go to college.
Mm.
It's about go to college, become a doctor, lawyer, engineer, or doctor, engineer, lawyer in that order,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's so that you would have a comfortable life and have like a good job, right?
Yeah.
But that's not really how you get ahead. Like if you become a doctor, if you want to become partner, you need some soft skills.
Yes.
Right? If even coming out of med school, if you don't want to wait 10 years to become a partner, you need to have connections.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where do those connections come from? Well, that came from your roommate or fraternity mate in college.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, it's through my white parents that I learned like, oh, We have not had a sitting president that was never part of a fraternity, mm-hmm. right? We have never had a Supreme Court justice that wasn't part of the Greek system, sorority, fraternity. 80% of our Congress in history has been part of a Greek system,
right?
So my mom said, listen, you probably won't like the frat life in college.
Doesn't matter.
But don't look down on those people.
Yeah.
Because those are the people in the halls of power. And so make some friends mm-hmm. that are in fraternities. Like, I didn't end up joining fraternities. Like, at UCSD, the fraternity scene is not that great. There's no real big advantage. You know, like, you don't get, like, free tests and stuff. And, you know, they don't have a house necessarily on campus and all that. But, you know, I was mindful of, like, let's not talk shit about the frat guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because those are the people that would become Congress people.
Absolutely.
And so, Laura, think about it today, right? If one of my children, or like with all the Asian hate stuff, if like one of my elders was like beaten down and that was caught on camera, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me to try to find someone to advocate for that, I need to work the phones. I need to bust a whole bunch of emails, get on LinkedIn, find someone I'm connected to, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I was in a fraternity, there might be someone who had dinner with my auntie.
Yeah.
Right. Has nothing but fond memories of. I don't have to ask him. He's already on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's mostly taught me not really civic, but business versions of those kind of power levers, which I think are not, it's not inaccessible to immigrants. It's just not very obvious to immigrants.
Yeah.
I don't think
so. Wow. Well, that is really interesting. And I love that that's what you learned and that you can differentiate it like that. Like what you learned from your Korean parents and what you learned from your white parents and how they're both entrepreneurs in different ways. And that networking, man, is clutch. Scott and I were just talking about that. We're going to need to end because we're out of time. But
oh, no.
I know.
I thought this was a 2-hour show. Laura, what's going on?
Tell me, June, where can people...
I have a feeling you've said that before.
I know, right? Where can people find you?
The easiest place to get all my updates is just to find me on LinkedIn, June S. Han. That's why I do that, because there's like five other June Hans that have done much more in life than I have. So you got to put the S in there. So I'm the one that shows up, or you just look up on the TEDx website, look up Get Ahead by Giving Back mm-hmm. and you can watch that TED talk there as well. So
great. Great. Thank you so much, June.
Yeah. Really fascinating story.
Fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's my privilege and honor to be here.
You're just also the nicest guy and just so much fun to talk to you. So I appreciate you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, June.
Appreciate you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.